Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 198 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. And in today's podcast, I'm going to be talking about like just high yield anti-hypertensive integrations for the USMLE Step 1, Step 2 CK, and Step 3 exams. I would say this podcast should be relevant to pretty much anyone taking any of the USMLEs. At the same time as I'm recording this podcast, I'm also trying out this video format. I'm trying to actually record this video at home, believe it or not. I just want to see how it works, and then I'll probably put it on the YouTube channel and see if this is a format that people are also interested in, because hopefully in this new year, we really want to make a lot of videos that hopefully people should find to be helpful. So let's just jump right into it. So what if they give you a question about a person that's pregnant and they ask you to recommend an antihypertensive? So, I mean, this is just going to be, again, kind of like my podcast, right? It's just going to be like a regular discussion. So what kind of antihypertensive would you want to give in pregnancy? Well, I would hope you're saying something along the lines of like hydralazine, right? So remember, you can give like hydralazine, you can give alpha-methyl-DOPA, right? You can give labetalol, right? In fact, and then you can also give nifedipine. In fact, there is this mnemonic that I learned back in the day when I was studying for step one, that's hypertensive moms love nifedipine. So hypertensive moms love nifedipine to essentially help you remember the antihypertensives that are safe in pregnancy, right? So hydralazine is one of them. Alpha-methyl-DOPA is another. Labetalol is another, and nifedipine is. One thing that your friends at the MBME love to test pretty commonly actually is how you should never give an ACE inhibitor or an ARB to a pregnant female. You do that, you're putting that baby at risk, right? Because those antihypertensives are teratogenic, right? They can cause renal dysfunction in the fetus, so you don't want to do those. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has hypertension and, you know, potentially has stable angina at the same time? Is there a drug you'd want to add to his antihypertensive regimen? But I hope you're thinking in terms of a nitrate, right? Nitrates are amazing, right, for treating angina, right? Because they dilate your coronary vessels, right? Although that's a minor effect. The predominant effect of nitrates is that they are venodilators. And if you dilate veins, right, that will decrease the preload that the heart is facing. And if the heart is seeing less preload, then the heart is going to not have to use as much oxygen. So the myocardial oxygen demand goes down when a person is taking a nitrate. That's the primary mechanism behind nitrates being useful for the treatment of angina. Because many people think, oh, it's because they're predominantly coronary vasodilators. That is actually not true. The thing they do is they decrease the myocardial oxygen demand. So by decreasing the myocardial, they do that by just putting less preload. So your end diastolic volume actually goes down when you're placed on a nitrate, right? So your heart doesn't need to expend as much energy. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that is hypertensive and the person has migraines? Is there a particular kind of drug or drug class you'd want to give that person? Well, I would hope you're telling me something along the lines of like a beta blocker, right? So beta blockers, they're pretty good for the treatment of hypertension. They work really well, but they also, I mean, they're not great for hypertension, but they're good for migraines, right? And again, by migraine therapy, I mean like chronic migraine therapy, right? So obviously, if a person has an acute migraine, you're going to go ahead and give them a triptan. You're going to give them like sumatriptan, rizatriptan, something like that, right? But if a person is having like 8 or more migraine episodes in a month, right, then you want to give them something a little better, right? Something that can prophylax against migraine so that they have fewer migraine attacks. And you'd want to use something along the lines of like a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? Alternative to something like verapamil or diltiazem, those are pretty helpful with migraines. But another thing you also want to use is you want to use a beta blocker, like a non-selective beta blocker like propranolol. Those are also pretty good in terms of prophylaxis for migraines. Now, what if they give you a question about a person and they tell you that this person has a history of hypertension, but they also have a history of like systolic heart failure, any heart failure for that matter, and they have like peripheral edema? Then what drug class would you want to give those people that could also help with their hypertension and the edema? Well, I hope you're telling me a loop diuretic, right? So remember your loop diuretics. So drugs like furosemide, bumetanide, torsemide, ethocrinic acid. Remember, ethocrinic acid's claim to fame is that it doesn't have the sulfur allergy that's associated with the other loop diuretics, right? The other loop diuretics contain sulfur groups. So if a person has a bad sulfur allergy, the other loop diuretics, with the exception of ethocrinic acid, probably not the best idea in the world. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has hypertension? Well, this person also has a history of osteoporosis. What kind of drug would you want to give those people? Well, I hope you're telling me that you want to give them a thiazide, right? Remember, loops lose calcium, but thiazides retain calcium, right? So if a person is placed on a thiazide, and the mechanism behind this, I already described it in my renal podcast. I think that's like an episode in the 50s on my website. And the website, by the way, is Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end.com. You can find all my podcasts there. So this is episode 198. And basically, right, thiazides, they help you reabsorb more calcium in the nephron, right? So they're actually good for a person that has like a history of like nephrolithiasis, right? And they're also good for a person that has a history of osteoporosis, because they're essentially causing hypercalcemia, but at the same time, they are causing a hypocalciuria. So they are good from that perspective. They are very, very good at, you know, raising your blood calcium level. So they are helpful if a person has a history of hypertension and osteoporosis, right? Now, just going off of that nephrolithiasis business that I talked about, remember, thiazides are good for nephrolithiasis because they reduce the amount of calcium that's in your urine. But your loop diuretics are bad for a person that has a history of nephrolithiasis, right? Because by giving a loop diuretic, remember, again, loops make you dump calcium in the nephron. If you dump more calcium in the nephron, right, then you have a higher risk of having that calcium precipitate and cause like a calcium nephrolithiasis, right? So loop diuretics are maybe not the best idea if a person has a history of nephrolithiasis and they have hypertension. Now, what are the antihypertensives that are decent in a person that has a history of heart failure? Well, basically, I'm essentially asking you the question, what are the drugs that improve survival in heart failure, right? You want to think about drugs that are more along the lines of like your beta blockers. In fact, there are some specific ones. There's like metoprolol, right? There's the carvedilol. And then there's there's bisoprolol, right? So like MCB, right? So like metoprolol, carvedilol, and bisoprolol. Those drugs, they have all been shown to improve survival in heart failure, right? Those are your beta blockers. Remember, your ACE inhibitors and your ARBs have also been shown to improve survival in heart failure, right? So drugs like your lisinopril or your candesartan or your telmisartan, those drugs improve survival. And then your aldosterone receptor antagonists, right? So like spironolactone, eplerenone, right? Those also improve survival. And then if you're looking at a person that has a history of like an African-American with heart failure, you can also give the drug known as Bidyl. Bidyl is like a combination of isosorbidinitrate and hydralazine. It helps quite a lot to actually control our symptoms of hypertension, but it also helps with heart failure symptoms, right? So again, the basic construct I'm going after in this podcast is, if a person has hypertension and certain other comorbidity, that may guide the kind of therapy that you're going with regards to hypertension. And then if a person, for example, has a history of hyperthyroidism, right, and they have a history of hypertension, what drug can you give to kill two birds with one stone? Well, I hope you're telling me that you're going to give those people a beta blocker, right? You give those people beta blockers because beta blockers, right, especially propranolol, remember it inhibits the 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3 in the periphery, right? Remember, it's one of those drugs you can use for thyroid storm, right? But again, beta blockers, yes, they are not first line for treating hypertension, but if a person has hypertension and this comorbidity of having like hyperthyroidism or thyroid storm, blah, 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 then yes, those people, it'd be reasonable to go ahead and give them a beta blocker, especially like a propranolol. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has a history of hypertension? Well, this person at the same time also has a history of BPH. What drug class would you want to consider in that person? Well, I hope you're telling me that you want to give them an alpha-1 blocker, right? Remember, your alpha-1 blockers are drugs like prazosin, terazosin, doxazosin. By blocking alpha-1 receptors, you decrease systemic vascular resistance, and that should lower a person's blood pressure, right? But also by blocking those alpha-1 receptors, you open up that bladder neck, right? And the person's bladder will be able to drain better, right? So if a person has a history of BPH and they have a history of hypertension, then an alpha-1 antagonist is not a terrible idea. And just as an offset, remember when if a person has, you know, just BPH and you don't want to tank their blood pressures, then it may not be a bad idea to give them the alpha-1 blocker tamsulosin. Remember, tamsulosin is an alpha-1 AD receptor antagonist, right? So AD as in Anthony Davis. You can probably tell at this point from my podcast that I'm a Lakers fan. But basically, an alpha-1 AD receptor blocker. The alpha-1 AD receptors are found predominantly in the bladder neck. You don't really find them in the vasculature. So they can essentially work specifically on the bladder, right? But they will not necessarily work on the bloodstream, okay? But again, the big picture thing here, you have a history of BPH, you have hypertension, you're getting put on an alpha-1 antagonist. And then, what if they give you a question about a person that is hypertensive and the person has a dry cough, what kind of side effect are they experiencing? What drug class is causing that side effect? Well, I hope you're telling me that it's an ACE inhibitor, right? Remember, ACE inhibitors, they inhibit angiotensin converting enzyme, right? And ACE, the enzyme, is also something that helps you break down bradykinin. So if you're not able to break down bradykinin, the unfortunate thing that will happen is you'll have elevations. If you're not able to break down bradykinin because ACE has been taken out of the equation, then your levels of bradykinin will go up, and that will potentially precipitate the dry cough that we see. Usually, your next step in management on MBM exams for those folks is to go ahead and switch them to an ARB, to an angiotensin II receptor blocker. And something just came to my mind. There is one question that your friends at the MBM occasionally love to test, and they may ask you, where is the site of action of an ACE inhibitor, right? And then they may put kidney as an answer choice. Again, you don't want to make that kind of mistake, because think about it. Where do we find angiotensin converting enzyme? We find it predominantly in the lungs, right? Along the endothelial cells that constitute the lung capillaries, right? So the site of action of an ACE inhibitor, believe it or not, is in the lungs. You may say, oh, Devine, that's kind of obvious, but that's not something that people think about all the time. So it's just something, again, to keep in mind as you're taking these exams. Now, what kind of antihypertensive will be contraindicated in a person that has a history of hereditary angioedema or bilateral renal artery stenosis? Well, I hope you're telling me an ACE inhibitor and ARB, right? Because again, if you think about it, if a person has hereditary angioedema, they have a deficiency of an enzyme known as C1 esterase inhibitor. And the thing is, again, C1 esterase inhibitor helps you break down bradykinin. So the thing is, it's bad enough you're already inhibiting ACE, which also helps you break down bradykinin. If you concomitantly have a deficiency of C1 esterase inhibitor, then you're not able to break down bradykinin. And then that patient gets in trouble for sure, right? Their throat closes up and all that badness, right? So you don't want any of those things, right? So that's why ACE inhibitors, ARB, is bad in people that have a history of hereditary angioedema. But they're also bad in people that have a history of bilateral renal artery stenosis. Because again, if you think about it, if a person has renal artery stenosis, what is happening to the perfusion of the afferent arterioles? It's not great, right? So the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries are in the toilet. They're terrible, right? So your body is like, okay, since my hydrostatic pressures in the glomerular capillaries are in the toilet, let me try to fix this by revving up the renin angiotensin aldosterone system, making more angiotensin II, and then causing a constriction of the efferent arteria. Well, if that happens, that will raise the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries. That would be great, and at least you'll essentially maintain your renal perfusion and your glomerular perfusion pressures. But if you take an ACE inhibitor and ARB and you take angiotensin II out of the equation, you blunt that body's response to try to fix that problem, then the thing that will ultimately happen is that the efferent arteriole will not be constricted anymore. So that will tank the pressures in the hydrostatic pressures in your glomerular capillaries some more, and then the patient gets into big, big, big trouble, right? So that is why primarily, if a person has bilateral renal artery stenosis, you do not give those people ACE inhibitors or ARBs. The classic way that tends to show up on MBM exams is they'll give you a question about a person, and they'll tell you that, oh, you know, this person has a history of hypertension, yada, yada, yada. And then they'll tell you that, oh, this person was placed on lisinopril or something, right? And then they'll give you labs like 1 month ago when the drug was started and labs now. And you'd be like, man, this person's kidney function is not doing well. Like the creatinine was like 1.2 back then. Now it's like 2.1. Oh, what's up with that, right? And they'll have like hyperkalemia because they are now retaining potassium, and hyperphosphatemia because they are now retaining phosphate because their kidneys don't work. If you see that, that's essentially a backhand's way of your friends at the MBME asking you, essentially testing you about a person having bilateral renal artery stenosis as the potential cause of their hypertension to start with, right? So again, I know you may say, oh, Devine, you're being super specific here, but I promise you these things are all very high yield to know for purposes of the USMLE exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that's on a diuretic for hypertension, right? Like a thiazide, like hydrochlorothiazide for hypertension. And then they tell you that this person is hypokalemic, and then they ask for your next best step in management. What would you want to do? Well, I would hope under those circumstances, you're thinking about adding a potassium sparing diuretic, right? So something like an aldosterone receptor antagonist, like spironolactone or eplerenone. Remember, spironolactone causes the big boobies, right? So the gynecomastia, but eplerenone does not, because eplerenone does not have the added mechanism of action of being able to block androgen receptors, right? And also your innate channel blockers like amiloride and triamterene, right? Those are also potassium sparing diuretics. So you're taking advantage of your hyperkalemia side effect to temper the hypokalemia side effect that's associated with taking a regular diuretic like a loop or a thiazide. Again, that's a high yield concept to know for exams. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that is hypertensive because they have Kohn syndrome, right? Remember, Kohn syndrome is also known as primary hyperaldosteronism. What kind of drug would you want to give those people? I hope you're telling me again, you want to give them an aldosterone antagonist, right? Because again, you're essentially attacking the primary pathophysiology of what those people have, right? Because again, by taking an aldosterone receptor antagonist, right, you're essentially blocking aldosterone receptors. So the Kohn syndrome, the adrenal cortical adenoma that's making a ton of aldosterone, you're essentially taking that out of commission, right? Because again, you're essentially limiting the ability of that aldosterone to function in the person's body by blocking those receptors. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that was recently started on an antihypertensive and then they develop a Miller rash? What should you be thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about like drug-induced lupus, right? Remember, drug-induced lupus can be caused by like your sulfonamides, can be caused by hydralazine, which will be the answer in this case, and then isoniazid, which is a TB drug. Phenytoin can also cause drug-induced lupus, right? Procainamide can also cause drug-induced lupus. So they could also just make a question about a person that has a history of WPW. It's now being well controlled. And then the person develops a Miller rash. Again, think of drug-induced lupus. And then etanercept, that's a decoy receptor against the TNF-alpha, can also cause drug-induced lupus, right? But in this case, person being treated with an antihypertensive and then they develop a Miller rash, think about drug-induced lupus from hydralazine. Okay, think about drug-induced lupus from hydralazine. And this idea just, again, kind of popped into my mind so I don't forget. If a person has aortic dissection, given hydralazine is a terrible idea, you will always get that NBME question wrong if you do that. Hydralazine actually worsens outcomes if you use it to lower a person's blood pressure in the setting of an aortic dissection. Again, very high yield to know that for purposes of the USMLE exams. Now, and remember that your drug-induced lupus, right, as a result, like antihistone antibodies, right? That's just a factoid you don't need to commit to memory. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has a history of hypertension, but also has a history of like bipolar disorder, right? And is there a particular kind of antihypertensive? It's sort of kind of a diuretic that can help with like lithium toxicity from bipolar disorder. So say, for example, like a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, or they have the tremors or whatever from lithium. What drug can we use specifically to help with the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus that's also an antihypertensive? Well, I hope you're telling me about the innate channel blockers, right? Again, like amiloride and triamterene. Remember, lithium, if you remember from Gen Chem, I also tutor people for college courses. If you sort of think back to general chemistry, remember that lithium is in group one of the periodic table, kind of like sodium. I think lithium is like element 3, and then sodium is like element 11, right? So they all use the same, because they have like one outermost shell, lone electron that's reactive, right? They have very similar chemical properties. So that innate channel that you find at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, believe it or not, lithium also uses that to get in and screen the second messenger system of ADH, right? So that's how it causes nephrogenic DI. So the thing is, if lithium is using that innate channel to gain access and cause problems, then it would make sense that one thing you could potentially do is to, you know, just go ahead and give something that will block that innate channel, like amiloride triamterene. And those are actually the drugs of choice in treating very high yield, in treating the nephrogenic diabetes insipidus associated with the use of lithium. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that is being treated for a hypertensive emergency, right? And then this patient now develops like a lactic acidosis, has like altered mental status. What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about like cyanide toxicity, right? Remember, classically, when a person has a hypertensive emergency or urgency on an NBME exam, the drug you would want to use is something like nitroprusside, right? Now, the thing with nitroprusside is that nitroprusside contains cyanide groups. So if a person has like a long nitroprusside infusion, that could potentially cause issues with cyanide poisoning, right? Which is bad, right? And how do you treat cyanide poisoning? Well, you can take one of two routes on an NBME exam. You can give hydroxocobalamin. It's like a vitamin B12 derivative. Alternatively, one other thing you could do is you could go ahead and give ammonitrate. Ammonitrate is a powerful oxidizing agent. So we'll convert the hemoglobin that person has in their body, at least some of it, to methemoglobin. Remember, hemoglobin has iron in the 2 plus form, but methemoglobin has iron in the 3 plus form, right? Methemoglobin is a very powerful binder of cyanide. So if you give ammonitrate, remember it's a nitrate, so powerful oxidizing agent. So you give that, you know, the person will have elevated levels of methemoglobin that will bind up the cyanide, and then give like sodium thiosulfate. And then they will form a complex known as thiocyanate that they can then pee and poop out successfully, right? So again, high yield stuff to know, right? And one unusual question your friends at the MBMA could set up. Again, this is just popped in. Again, you may notice from my, because I feel like, you know, I've not really done much in the way of videos. But if you listen to my podcast, you may see me take all these sidebars. Whenever you see me take sidebars, it's because of an idea that just drops in my mind as I'm kind of like talking on the spur of the moment, right? So the thing is, ammonitrate, can actually see the MBME writing a question where ammonitrate will be contraindicated in a person that has a history of like G6PD deficiency, right? Because people that have G6PD deficiency, they cannot deal with oxidative stress very well, right? So you wouldn't want to give them something that is a powerful oxidizing agent like ammonitrate. That'll actually be a genius MBME question. Who knows? Maybe they are listening to this and they'll probably write a question that tests that concept in the future. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of hypertension and has PTSD? Is there an antihypertensive that's actually great for PTSD? Well, I hope you're telling me something along the lines of like prazosin. Remember, people that have PTSD, they tend to have like these nightmares, these flashbacks. Prazosin or any other alpha-1 blocker is actually pretty good for helping with those nightmares that accompany PTSD. So that will actually be a good drug, again, to treat that comorbidity. I can totally see that being like a psych question on the USMLEs or a psych shock question in third year. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient that has a history of hypertension, but they also have some kind of vasospastic disease like Raynaud's phenomenon? What kind of drug would you want to give those people? Well, I would hope you're saying to give those people a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So drugs like amlodipine, felodipine, nifedipine, right? Those are dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? They cause vasodilation, right? So if a person has like a vasospastic disease, right? So they can make it like a scleroderma question, or they can even give you a question about a person that has, what's the name of this disorder? Buerger's disease, right? That vasculitis that's found in smokers, right? So those people, if they have hypertension, a dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker may not be the worst idea under those circumstances. And then, what if they give you a question about a person that has a hypertensive emergency or urgency? What are the drugs you can give on an MBME exam? I already mentioned one. You can give sodium nitroprusside, right? But another drug you can give labetalol, you can give nicardipine, or you can give clavidipine. You may say, Duvan, you're giving 4 specific names. I promise you, these 4 specific names, they are the only answers that will be correct for your exam. I'll say that again. Nicardipine, clavidipine, labetalol and sodium nitroprusside. Those are the antihypertensives that are safe in the treatment of a hypertensive emergency or urgency, where again a person has like really high blood pressures and they have like end organ damage. Do not give hydralazine, do not give nifedipine. You give those, you will get the question wrong. I'm literally promising you that, right? So you don't want to get into those kinds of troubles on exams. Now, are there some drugs that are some antihypertensives that are contraindicated when a person has like an acute decompensation of CHF? Well, I hope you're thinking along the lines of like your beta blockers, right? So again, if a person's heart is acutely like, you know, kind of like in the toilet, not working very well, it would not make much sense to give them drugs that can depress their cardiac function even more, like a negative inotrope, like a beta blocker, or a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil or diltiazem. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that has a history of hypertension, but they also have a history of AFib? Is there a particular drug class that would be reasonable for those people? Well, I hope you're telling me that you could potentially give them like, again, a beta blocker, right? Or a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So basically your class 2 and your class 4 antiarrhythmics, right? They're pretty good for the treatment of AFib, right? Like chronic therapy for AFib, right? So if a person has a history of hypertension and they have those problems, they may not be the worst idea in the world to give them those kinds of drugs. Now, there's this scenario that kind of popped up in my mind. What kind of antihypertensive will be contraindicated in a person that has a history of like second degree heart block, like Mobitz 2 or like third degree heart block? What kind of drug will be contraindicated there? Well, I would hope you're telling me that you don't want to give those people, again, beta blockers or non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, verapamil, diltiazem, right? Because if a person has heart block, yeah, if you know he's already going at a snail's pace, right? It would not make sense to like, oh, you know, you're going at a snail's pace, let me put you to a complete halt. That's probably not a good idea, right? Because again, you don't want them to, you know, kind of like die of like a really nasty bradyarrhythmia, right? So if a person has a history of like heart block, especially like a really bad one, like Mobitz 2 or type like a third degree heart block, or even a person that has a history of like WPW, right, where they have like that a sensory bundle of Kent, you don't want to give those people an AV nodal blocking agent, right? Because if you give them that AV nodal blocking agent, then the thing that will happen is that they will then have more flux through that Kent bundle, right? And say, for example, let's say they have the WPW and they have like a concomitant AFib. If you block their AV nodes, right, and then it's the Kent bundle that's the only thing that's available, you will essentially convert that AFib that they have in their atria to VFib, right? And then they will die, right? And you know, that's usually not a good outcome, right? So it's never a good outcome, let's put it that way, right? So yeah, so if a person has WPW, do not give an AV nodal blocking agent. Because this is a hypertension podcast, I'm advising again, don't give a beta blocker and don't give a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker. But one off-target, off-putting thing that, again, you may not see mentioned all the time is, if a person has WPW, digoxin is a bad idea, right? Digoxin, many people just think of digoxin as a positive inotrope, which it is. But the other thing that digoxin does is, digoxin is also a muscarinic receptor agonist, okay? So it actually slows conduction down the AV node. So digoxin is not a good idea for a person that has a history of WPW. Because again, that will encourage more flux through the bundle of Kent, which is bad. Right now, what if they give you a question about a person that you know is having, because they've had like, you know, really bad nasty resistant hypertension, and you find out that it's from a pheochromocytoma, right? And then you're like, okay, we're gonna go ahead and take you for surgery. What kind of pre-surgical antihypertensive planning would you want to go with? Well, I would hope you're saying to give an alpha blocker first, right? So you can give like phenoxybenzamine, right? Phenoxybenzamine is an irreversible alpha 1 blocker, right? And then, so you block alpha receptors first before you block beta receptors, because again, if you give a beta blocker first, then you have that unopposed alpha stimulation, and the person can get a hypertensive crisis and die. You don't want that, right? That's not, again, not an ideal outcome, right? So you give alpha blockade first. After you give alpha blockade, you then go ahead and give beta blockade. So hopefully that's something that makes sense to you. Now, what if you get a question, and actually a similar concept kind of applies to a person that has like cocaine overdose, right? Again, if a person has cocaine overdose, you don't want to give a beta blocker. That's not a smart idea because, again, unopposed alpha business. But you can give an alpha beta blocker. You can give like labetalol. Works great in a cocaine overdose. You can give nitroprusside. Just don't give a beta blocker and you'll be fine for the most part. And usually people that also have cocaine overdose, they actually tend to respond pretty well to benzos. Benzos are usually very good with treating many of the hyperadrenergic symptoms that those patients are having. And then... if a person has nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, what kind of antihypertensive drug in general is good for nephrogenic diabetes insipidus? Well, I would hope you're telling me that you want to, you know, consider a thiazide. Right? Thiazides are good for nephrogenic DI, again, with the exception of a person having nephrogenic DI from lithium toxicity, right? Again, if you give a thiazide, that will potentially worsen the lithium tox, like the nephrogenic DI associated with lithium, like as a lithium side effect, because again, I kind of said this in a prior podcast, so I'm not going to belabor that fact here, but anything that would increase the activity of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system will worsen lithium toxicity. Because, and the reasoning behind that is, if your renin angiotensin aldosterone system is working really well, then aldosterone levels will be high, and when aldosterone is high, aldosterone increases the activity of that INEC channel that we find at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct. So if a person has nephrogenic DI from lithium toxicity, the drugs of choice are your INEC channel blockers. Amiloride, triamterin, not a thiazide, right? Not a thiazide. Because thiazides will make you volume depleted, and then in response, your renin angiotensin aldosterone system will get revved up. That INEC channel will work really well, and then you'll get more lithium toxicity because the lithium will be reabsorbed at an accelerated rate, right? That's also why NSAIDs are terrible ideas in people that are experiencing lithium toxicity. Because NSAIDs, they will inhibit the synthesis of prostaglandins. So if you inhibit prostaglandin synthesis, then your afferent arterial will be constricted, right? And if it's constricted, you will hypoperfuse those GG cells, and then they'll freak out and start leaking a ton of renin. Now, what are some antihypertensives that are contraindicated in a person that has a history of gout? Well, I hope you're telling me like your thiazides and your loops, right? Because your thiazides and your loops, they interfere with the excretion of uric acid in the nephron. So if you're taking a thiazide or a loop, as your body's trying to get rid of that thiazide or loop, because drugs don't stay in the body forever, then you would not lose as much uric acid in your urine. And then you have a higher risk of precipitating those uric acid crystals in your body, like maybe like your great toe, your first MTP, and then you get into troubles with gout. Now, what if they tell you that a person was recently started on an antihypertensive or like a heart failure drug and then they have gynecomastia? What are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking spironolactone, right? Because again, it blocks aldosterone receptors, but it also blocks androgen receptors. And then if they give you a question about a person that has a history of hypertension and they have renal failure, or a history of hypertension and they have diabetes, what is the preferred drug class for those people to treat their hypertension? Well, I hope you're telling me to go ahead and give those people like an ACE inhibitor or an ARB, right? Remember, ACE inhibitors, again, by mechanisms I've described in multiple podcasts, right? They decrease something known as intraglomerular hypertension, right? So hyperfiltration injury does not happen, right? So that slows down the rate of decay of the person's kidneys, right? Because if you remember from the GNC guidelines for hypertension, you typically would not want to start with an ACE inhibitor, an ARB, in an African American. But this is the one key high yield exception to that rule. If a person has a history of hypertension and they have diabetes or they have renal failure, ACE inhibitors or ARBs are the preferred agents in those patient populations. Now, what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, was studied on an antihypertensive and they miss a dose and their blood pressure just goes sky high? What drug class are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about like the alpha 2 agonist, clonidine, right? Clonidine, it has this classic association of rebound hypertension. And remember that clonidine also has like some very high yield uses on NVMEs. You can actually use it to treat like opioid withdrawal, right? Because again, opioids, right, by acting on those mu receptors, they decrease the synthesis, the release of catecholamines at the adrenergic synapse. Well, guess what? Clonidine, by being an alpha 2 agonist, also inhibits the release of catecholamines like norepinephrine at the adrenergic synapse. So clonidine essentially works like an opioid. Believe it or not, in some localities in the US, clonidine is a street drug, right? Because it makes your opioid withdrawal symptoms not feel as bad. Right. In fact, if you're a resident or you're doing like a rotation, if you hear about opioid power plants that are used to manage like opioid withdrawal in the hospitals, they almost always include clonidine. Right. So clonidine can be used for opioid withdrawal. And the higher thing you want to keep in mind with clonidine is you can actually use it as first line for the treatment of Tourette's. Remember, Tourette's first line, you use your alpha 2 agonists like clonidine or guanfacine. Second line, you use your atypical antipsychotics. Third line, you use your typical antipsychotics. At least that's what the NBME kind of recognizes. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. This has gone on for over 30 minutes. And again, this is my first like home video. So let's see how this works. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams, right? So step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. If you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for like your internal medicine entering exam or your internal medicine ABIM board exam, or let's say you're a college student and you need tutoring for like general chemistry, organic chemistry, physics, biochemistry, histology, physiology, basically many of the MCAT subjects or many of the pre-med subjects. Like again, I do offer tutoring for all those things. And then and the kind of tutoring I mostly do one-on-one tutoring with people. But another thing I also do is I also do like large group tutoring, right? So if you're interested in any of those things, either reach out to me through the website or you send me an email, Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. And if you're a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, or a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, I do offer again like one-on-one like coaching, one-on-one advising for those things. So like personal statements, mock interviews, editing applications, and all that stuff. Again, I have like admissions committee experience. I've worked on the admissions committee of a top 2 med school for like a year. So again, I have experience reviewing high quality applications, and I've also worked with tons of people that have successfully matched into residency. So that's it pretty much. I hope you enjoyed this video. For those of you that are listening, please subscribe to the podcast and subscribe to the YouTube channel as well. It's called Divine Intervention Podcasts and Videos. Subscribe, hit subscribe, and I guess we'll see how things go. But yes, this year my game plan is to make a crap ton of podcasts, especially from more from a step 2 CK perspective, but also pretty heavily from a step 1 perspective, and then also expand into all these specialties like internal medicine, make more internal medicine podcasts, make some podcasts for some other specialties that are peripherally related to internal medicine. So let's just see, it's just time that's my biggest almost my biggest limiting factor. If I had more time, I would make more podcasts because most of my days end up being extremely busy. So I will see you in the next podcast. Thank you for listening. And again, just give me feedback in the comments. If you have any questions or you have any topics that you want podcast made on, again, just reach out to me either in the comment section or you can send me an email. I'll be more than happy. If it's a reasonable request, I'll be more than happy to make a podcast on that topic because there's many podcasts I have in my head. I just don't have time to make those podcasts. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'm glad the Lakers are on a winning streak now, and I hope they continue that tomorrow when they play their game. So I'll see you next time. God bless you. Thank you.